When I was studying at university, I read a book. I read lots of books, but one in particular I want to share with you. It was a biography of a Christian and a Christian pastor who was leading a church in England back in the end of the 18th century, so the end of the 1900s. He was leading a church then. It told you about his life, his conversion, his coming to ministry, and just wrestling with the issues he faced. And it was a really encouraging book. I didn't have to read this because I was studying math, so it was something I just happened to be reading while I was at university, in case you're confused about that. It was an encouraging book to read. But there was this one thing that was pivotal for his thinking about Christianity. He was looked at his life and he was dissatisfied with his experience as being a Christian. He felt that there was more. There should have been more. He should have been feeling more as a Christian. He should have been experiencing more of God's life, of the Spirit empowering him to live God's way. He was dissatisfied with what he was doing. And so he looked to how to break into this kind of life. And he thought about this and he referred to it as holiness. He had to break into the holy life, a life of holiness. Whether it was him by personal effort or whether it was just by divine blessing, he had to somehow make it into this level of Christianity, this level of experiencing closeness with God and a walk with God that was lived out in closeness with him in a way that was really tangible and a way that felt real and it felt powerful. Now, as a Christian, I'd grown up in a church that taught the Bible really well, and I was reading this book and it immediately made me a bit uncomfortable. I was a bit suspicious of this, thinking it's kind of like this two-stage Christianity where you can become a Christian and you believe and you have faith and you're saved, but then there's this next level to break into to receive the full Christian life, the full experience of grace, of godliness. And so I was suspicious of that, and I still am today. It's not, I don't think, what the Bible teaches. But I did sympathize with his kind of thinking about life, that sometimes it does feel dissatisfying, the Christian life that we have. Sometimes it feels like there should be more. We should be feeling a closeness to God. We should be feeling a greater impact of the Spirit on our lives. And so I sympathize with his desire. And I could see what he was trying to get at in going for holiness. And I think sometimes that's a common feeling we have as Christians. Lots of people feel that, don't we? This desire for more, something more real, more tangible, more powerful. And sometimes we get glimpses of something like that when we go to a conference and we feel like we've been challenged in a particular way and it struck us. And we're like, yeah, that's... I can see how that's real and it needs to impact my life and I want to go forward to live it out. Sometimes we kind of feel some of that closeness when we're, I don't know, singing a song and you get struck by the truth in such a way that it just makes you reflect and feel its reality a bit more than you normally do. And at those times, sometimes we take it as an indication that our life is going well as a Christian. It's good. And sometimes when we're not feeling that, it can become an indication to us that we're a second-class Christian. We're not living out this, not at the peak in the groove that God set out that you can get into. Or worse, sometimes we even feel that if we're not feeling that, then maybe that's an indication of the status of my salvation. Maybe I start to question my faith. Maybe I'm not genuinely trusting in Jesus. And that's really, it's really dangerous and an unhelpful way for us to be thinking. As we look at Leviticus, we see more about this concept of holiness, don't we? And we look at this book that talks about holiness perhaps more than any other book in the Bible and presents it in such a prominent way. And we get a picture of what it means for God's people to be holy. And more than that, what it means for God's people, his holy people, to live holy lives. And part of our mixed up thinking about holiness kind of just comes from a misunderstanding of what holiness is, in terms of our language about it, is unhelpful. So we often think about holiness as this sinlessness or perfection or purity, cleanness. those kind of things. We think about holiness, and those ideas are related to holiness. But when we look at the Bible, what's actually at the root is a much simpler idea than that. It's a much more basic idea, and all it is it means separated. It means set apart. To be holy is to be identified as different. And so, you see that in Leviticus 20:26. God says to the people, "You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples, that you should be mine." Holiness is about being separated. God chooses Israel and says, "You are to be different from all the other people. I'm going to treat you differently and set you apart." So that's at the heart of what holiness is. And it helps to think about the opposite of that. Is actually, it's not impure or it's not sinful or evil. The opposite of holiness is being common. Just being common. Maybe a helpful way to think about it is to think about it like knives. I don't know how knives get treated at your house, but this is the way, in my experience of using knives. You have a butter knife, don't you? And it's the jack of all trades knife. It can be used for just about anything. You use it for making kind of Vegemite sandwiches. It's not a very exalted task. You use it for just everyday use. I've even used butter knives to do up screws. And I've used butter knives to patch holes in the wall with spack filler. They get thrown around, and it's not treated very special, is it? That's the butter knife. A bit more special than that is the steak knife. I wouldn't use that on the wall. It's reserved for some special cases, like steak. A very important and special occasion. But also cutting other things that need their special sharpness and, sometimes cutting things that are more important. But the most holy of knives, the most special and set apart, I think, is the cheese knife. Do you guys have a cheese knife at your house? We have a cheese knife. And it gets used for nothing but cheese. Its one job is to cut cheese, and not only that, it's just to cut cheese on special occasions when there are visitors around, not just for ordinary cheese on ordinary sandwich. It's special occasions. That's its only job. That's reserved. It's set apart for cheese. The cheese knife is holy. Now, in a sense, it's just a knife. There's nothing special about it. It's just a bit of metal with a sharp edge, just like butter knives and steak knives. Any of them could do the job. But we treat it differently. We decide to set it apart, and this is to be the cheese knife, and it is to be used for cutting cheese. That's what holiness is. The setting apart and treating it as different. That's the basic idea of holiness. And that's also the basic idea of the other words that we use that kind of have the same idea. So words like sacred, saint, sanctified, consecrated. At their root, they're all ideas of just putting aside to be special and separate. And it's interesting, you know, that we do the same thing with those words. They're all words that just mean setting apart, but we restrict their use to only talking in about religious ideas. We kind of make the words holy for that special purpose. And so that's what's happening to Israel here. That's what God's doing to Israel. He's setting them apart, saying, "You are different from all the other people." We need to be reminded. Adam said it last week. I'm going to say it again. Israel didn't do this themselves. They didn't say, "Hang on, we're going to be special and all the other nations are just going to be common. We're going to set ourselves apart." This was God's choice. He was the one who decided to make Israel holy. So we see it here. "You shall be holy to me. I am the Lord, I am holy, and I have separated you from the peoples." And if you didn't get it there, 8 more times in the chapters of today's section, 17 to 22, it mentions again that God is the one who separates Israel. It's emphatic that it comes out that many times. God makes them holy. If we were thinking about He's making them holy, we should be asking the question in our heads, why? Why is God making this nation special and separate? Like we said, we set aside a cheese knife for the purpose of cutting cheese on special occasions. That's what it's we set it apart for. Why is God set apart Israel? Well, in the first instance, it's just to be His. You shall be holy to me. It should be mine. If you remember back when God brought Israel out of Egypt, He brought them into the desert to Mount Sinai, and He started talking to them, and this is what He said in Exodus chapter 19. Out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. They were to be His, treasured. As a special, just to enjoy a special relationship. But also, it's to be this extra dimension, they're to be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. Now, it's not to say that they were all just to work in the temple and serve Him and just go about doing the sacrifices and stuff like that. That's not what it's talking about. The priest's role was to mediate and to help people relate to God. And so, on a large kind of national scene, that was Israel's role as God's holy nation. The kingdom of priests was to, as a group of people, help the rest of the world relate to God. They were to be the ones who helped that relationship to happen. That was their special role and part of why God had set them apart from everyone else. So we see God sets aside Israel. They are holy. That's it. But being set aside as holy doesn't just end there. It has some implications for the way they were to live, for their lives. In the chapters we looked at last week, we saw that there was things to do with cleanliness, ritual purity that it meant. Being God's holy people meant they weren't to associate with death and blood and disease and certain types of animals. There were things that were unclean. In the chapters of this week, 17 to 22, the focus is not so much on the ritual cleanliness, but much more on the moral obligations of God's holy people. I see, they were to live lives that were ethically genuine. They were expressed integrity. If you flick back to chapter 18 or just look on the screen, there's a kind of introduction to this section, a little snapshot that helps us get our heads around what's going on. And see, God says, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do as they do in the land of Egypt where you lived. And you shall not do as they did in the land of Canaan, to which I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You shall follow my rules and keep my statutes and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my rules. If a person does them, he shall live by them. I am the Lord." You see, being God's holy people, being separate, has implications that they're to live separate, distinctive, different. They're not to live the same, and their lives aren't to look like the lives of the Egyptians or the Canaanites. They're to live differently. And we see here, this means in chapter 17 and chapters 21 and 22, that meant that their sacrificial practices and the way they went about that had to be different from the way the Egyptians and the Canaanites went about their sacrifices. In chapter 18, we see that their sexual ethics had to be different, had to align to God's standards, not the standards of the nations around. And we see in chapters 19, and with more of the consequences in chapter 20, that just their everyday living had to align to God's standards. So we're going to have a look at chapter 19. Unfortunately, we won't have time to go through every verse in detail. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Because there's some interesting verses there. Some seem like no-brainers, aren't they? Don't make your daughter into a prostitute. Hopefully, we don't have to be told that. But some of them are quite interesting and quite intriguing. Don't cut your sideburns. It's more interesting, isn't it? I hope when it was read it out earlier that you got a kind of general sense of what the life was expected. I hope you appreciated it. And we saw that the holiness here, it's not like a higher plane of Christian living, is it? It's not breaking into this second stage of being God's people, experiencing more and greater a closeness. Holiness is actually very mundane. It's about everyday decisions, everyday lives. It's about what you say to your neighbour and about what clothes you wear. It's about everyday things. Being God's holy people implies the need to have holy lives, different lives, at the very most basic level. There's a couple of common themes that we're going to look at, common themes that come out in chapter 19. Firstly, we see that the Israelites were to love. They were to be characterized by love. I see in verse 11, the way they're to treat their brothers. You shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, you shall not lie to one another. Pretty common. But instead, verse 18, you shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Love is to characterize the way they relate to other people. Secondly, they were to uphold justice. A couple of verses. Verse 15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. But in righteousness, you shall judge your neighbor. It's to be uphold justice and fairness. And that happened again at the end of the chapter, where you're not to cheat each other by having measures that were slightly wrong, to be able to kind of defraud people. You have to be true and righteous. Now, also, there's a concern for the weak, for the lowly, for the people who are vulnerable in society. There's lots of verses that bring that out, aren't there? They were to leave the gleanings of the field for the poor to be able to come and collect them and eat them. In verse 33, they were to look after the stranger, the foreigner who had come into their land. You're not to do him wrong, but you're to actually treat him as you would a common Israelite. You're to respect elderly people. There's this concern for the weak, the people who might normally get neglected. Now, you might notice something there. They're to love, they're to uphold justice, and they're to look after the vulnerable. Now, where else do we see those characteristics expressed in the Bible? Anyone? Who has characteristics like that? Jesus? God himself is like that, isn't he? See, these aren't random, as strange as some of them might seem to us. They're not just an arbitrary set of laws that God says, you're just to do these things to be different, just for no other reason to be different. But they flow out of his character. You have to do these things, and they're actually representing and being like God himself. That the Israelites were to be holy because he is holy. That was in verse 2, wasn't it? 19 verse 2. There's a way in which they're to reflect who God is, his character. And drawing on from that, there's a fourth kind of common theme that comes out, and that's there to not to mix their religious practices with the practices of the nations around. They're to keep focused on God's instruction and following his patterns. And you know, as Israel does this, as they love, as they uphold justice, as they look after the poor, as they live distinctively like this, what does it do to the nations around that look at them? When they see these characteristics, love and justice and looking after the poor, they see that's different. And why is it different? It's because your God is different. You're holy because he is holy. And in that way, as they take on the characteristics of God, they're fulfilling that role as being priests, a kingdom of priests. As they show the world around what God is like. I also want to draw your attention to the refrain that's repeated throughout these chapters. Did you notice it? At the end of almost every paragraph is the refrain, I am the Lord. or I am the Lord your God. And it kept coming, didn't it? It kept hitting you. And if you're there, as one of the Israelites, having this read out to you by Moses, it would be just thumping into you, wouldn't it? I am the Lord. Be holy, because I am holy. I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord. I am the Lord. I am the Lord your God. And partly it's reiterating his authority. He is their God. He is the one who has the right to instruct them on how to live. But more than that, it's reminding them again and again who he is. He is Yahweh. It's him that they are to be reflecting. It's him that their lives are to be characterized by. You think about it, when we separate a knife for using just for cheese. And when we do that, it shows that we consider cheese a little bit important, doesn't it? It shows that we consider cheese a little bit more important than butter, because we use butter knife for anything. And as Israel's life was separated, and as they actually did live distinctly, it shows that something significant was there about God. It shows the reality of his difference. He's not like the gods of the other nations. Perhaps you've noticed, I've been thinking in the back of your mind, with holiness, with this idea of being set apart, there's also a flip side. If God sets apart Israel to be special, to be his people, there's also the rest of the people that aren't set apart. There's the people who aren't holy to him. They're just common. And for us in Australia, that's most of us, if not all of us, fall into that category. Not God's holy people. But the good news is that Israel wasn't the only one, the only nation that God set apart. So he also chose from within that nation one individual, the one that his disciples refer to as the Holy One of God. And even the demons knew that he was the Holy One of God as they were being driven out by him. They used the same title. See, Jesus was set apart for a particular role. He was set apart for a purpose in God's plan. Apart from all the others, one man had this role, a special role to reveal God to Israel and to the nations, and to be the one who helped men relate to God. Not to be the kingdom of priests, but to be the one great high priest. And in doing so, required his death on the cross. But by that death, those who were not holy are able to be made holy. And the nations are able to be included with Israel as God's holy people. Are you and I, as Hebrews 10 expresses, we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ, once for all. Now don't miss that. That's a big thing. Now we don't belong to God's holy people Israel, but yet we can be included in through Jesus. Now because of this truth. Because of this reality, Peter is able to write to Christians in his letter, 1 Peter. He's able to write, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." See, what a privilege. Going from being not God's people to being God's holy people. And you notice those terms at the start? They look familiar? Chosen people, the royal priesthood, or our kingdom of priests. They're the very terms that God used of Israel, now being applied to Christians. Included in Christ. It's a great privilege. But just like was the case for Israel, that with the privilege of being God's set-apart people came the responsibility to live set-apart lives, so the same is true for Christians. And Peter goes on, in very small writing. He says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." I don't know about you, but I generally don't like to stand out. I like to blend in as one of the crowd. I don't like to draw unnecessary attention to myself, because it usually ends up being negative attention. But here, it's exactly what Peter is calling Christians to do. Not to live lives that look like everyone else, but to live as aliens and strangers in the world. As a holy people, set apart, different. Their lives are to be distinctive. As Christians, for you and I, that's the truth, that we don't belong. We're set apart. Therefore, we shouldn't conform, but we should live distinctively. Our lives should reflect the fact that we're holy, the fact that we have a holy God. Now, that won't necessarily look like all the things that look like for Israel. It won't necessarily mean that we, in outward physical appearance, don't look like the Egyptians or the Canaanites. But it will mean that our lives are distinctive because our characters are being shaped to look like our holy God. We should still be being filled with those characteristics, being filled with love for one another and for others, having a concern for justice, a concern for the weak and the downtrodden, the people who are vulnerable and that society doesn't look after very well. And the amazing thing is that as we do that, as we more and more take on the characteristics that God is characterized by, that people notice, and that we too can be acting as kingdom of priests. Did you notice there in the end of that verse, where they live such good lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. You see, holiness and holy living is a thing that's to be felt. It's to be experienced. But often our thinking about it is backwards. So we're not to feel it so much as a thing that we feel like we're entering into in this extra level of Christianity, but it's to be experienced more from the outside. And people to see us as holy and to experience, hang on, those people are different. So much so that even pagans will see it. Our people were to see our lives as different and even to be able to glimpse God's holiness reflected in us. It's a pretty incredible privilege that we have, that God would choose to use our lives that way. Imagine what would that look like in your situation. It is going to be slightly different for all of us. What does it mean for you to live a distinctive life amongst your family, amongst your friends, amongst your peers at university, or amongst your co-workers? In what way would your actions and your speech and your attitudes be different because you're shaped by God's character? Can you imagine what would happen if people around you started noticing, hang on, there's something about this guy or this girl that's different? I can see that they're not like general society. I wonder why that is. And can you imagine What it would be like if we were all having that experience. If in our community in Craybrook, that people were looking and going, hang on, Dan's different. And Haley's different. And Lachlan's different. And they all go to St. Thomas. What's special there? What's going on there? What's different about that place? What's different about what they believe? What's different about the God that they live for? Imagine what that would look like down at Good News Week, when we're all out engaging with people in the community. If we're all out running the fun day, having conversations, and yet our lives are so distinctive that people notice, even beyond the kind of the orange shirts that mark us all out as different, but actually because of our lives are different. Imagine how ready people would be to hear us talk about Jesus if they already know there's something different and special. Imagine how many people would be ready to actually sign up and go, yeah, I think I want to find out more. I want to do Christianity Explained. Imagine how many people God might choose to save and bring to glorify Himself. That's the privilege that we have as being God's holy people. That's the call that we have to live holy lives. It's a big vision, and it's exciting to think about. Imagine how much God might choose to do through us. Of being such a big vision and exciting, and it's right that we should commit it to God, shouldn't we? So I want to invite you to pray with me now as we ask the Holy God to work through us. Our great God, we thank you that even though we don't belong to your holy people, Israel, that you have included us, you have set us apart through the death of Christ. Thank you that we have this great privilege. Father, please work in our lives. Shape us that we may live lives that are set apart, that are distinctive, and reflect your distinctiveness. Reflect the fact that you are holy. And Father, please, through that, may you bring even pagans to glorify you. May you bring people to hear the gospel, to turn to Jesus and to be saved. Father, we pray this for the sake of your Son and in his name. Amen.